pouring myself a glass, a huge one. I want to get drunk. I want to leave home. Mostly, I want to avoid Simon. For the next 2 hours, I am on edge. I snap at Lachlan for spilling a drink and make Lucy cry when I'm brushing knots out of her hair. It's not fair on them. It's not fair on me. I hear Jack and Simon arriving home. They talk more loudly when they're with each other, like people who shout into mobile phones. They're not drunk, but they're each carrying an open beer and a six-pack. I don't look at Simon. He tries to hug me, but I turn my face away and arch my back.
"What's the matter?" he asks. "I had a shower."
"Dinner won't be long," I say, changing the subject. Jack begins telling me about their game, talking about his great comeback from 5 games down to win the deciding set. I glance at Simon and realize that he let Jack win. Others wouldn't be able to tell, but I know him too well. It's put Jack in a good mood, because he doesn't win often enough. Not since "I married and got fat," he says, patting his stomach. A remark aimed more at me, because Jack is the same weight as when I met him. Simon finishes his beer, and Jack gets him another. They sit on stools at the kitchen counter, watching me dress a salad and set the table.
"You look great," Simon says.
"Radiant," I reply, not hiding my sarcasm.
"When are you due?"
December 7th, says Jack.
Maybe I'm paranoid, but I sense Simon doing the calculations in his head, counting backwards, plotting the date of conception. Jack is still talking.
"Simon has been telling me that he wants to be a father. I told him he should get Gina pregnant, but he might want to put a ring on her finger first."
I don't reply. Both of them sense the tension, but Jack doesn't understand why.
"So, when did you decide you wanted a third?" asks Simon, directing the question at me.
"It wasn't exactly planned," says Jack.
"Weren't you taking precautions?"
"Do you remember Heston's 40th?
In Hampshire.
We had a bit of morning delight and played Russian roulette."
Again, I sense Simon doing the mental arithmetic. The silence stretches out.
"So, how are the kids?" he asks. "I thought I might see them."
"Lachlan is in bed. Lucy's watching TV in our room," I reply. I touch Jack's shoulder. "She wants you to say goodnight to her."
"I'll do it now."
Jack swallows the last of his beer, putting his tongue inside the bottle as though searching for the last drop. Alone with Simon, I begin wiping worktops that are already clean. Simon picks at the label of his beer with a thumbnail.
"You can't keep freezing me out, Megs. I'm Jack's best friend. I'm your friend."
"Why are you doing this?"
"We played tennis. I'm having a few beers. I've always been welcome in this house. You're like my second family."
"We're not." He stands and moves towards me. I step away, keeping the island worktop between us. "Why are you asking questions about my due date?"
"It's what people do. They ask about each other."
"Imagine if I stayed away. Jack would want to know why. What do I tell him?" "Nothing."
"You're punishing me for your mistake."
"It was our mistake."
"Sure, I cheated on Gina, but we're not married. So if we're going to start assigning blame, I think I know where most of it lies."
He's right, of course, which is all the more infuriating.
"So for your sake, and Jack's, I suggest you calm down and begin treating me nicely."
I start clearing away the empty bottles. Simon moves closer.
"You should worry about staying healthy and looking after that baby."
"Why do you care?"
He smiles. "You know the answer."
"This is not your baby."
"Prove it."
Agatha.
My mother has written another letter. This one has a red wine stain where she rested her glass.
"Dear Agatha, have you been thinking about coming to Spain for Christmas? We could get a car and drive along the coast, and I could introduce you to all my new friends. They're not all old like me, and the Spanish men are very handsome. The yacht club has a lifeguard who you'll be drowning to meet. If you don't want to see me, I'll understand. I've always depended upon strangers in life, so it shouldn't be any different now that my time is running out." My mother loves playing the death card on me, but she's as healthy as an ox, and she's not going to guilt me into being the dutiful daughter.
When my stepfather died, she tried to reconnect, that's the word she used, making it sound like one of us had accidentally kicked a plug out of the wall. I continue reading.
I forgot to tell you before now, but Mr. Bowler passed away recently. I know that you had your differences, but I hope you can find it in your heart to forgive him, just as I pray that you'll forgive me.
She's included a torn newspaper clipping from the Yorkshire Evening Post. Bowler, Charles Stewart, passed away peacefully on 18th of October in St. Anne's Hospice, aged 68. Mr. Bowler joyfully served as one of the Jehovah's Witnesses along with his wife Elizabeth, and children Helen, Nancy, Margaret and Bernice. He found great joy in glorifying the word of Jehovah, our Creator, by teaching the good news of the now established heavenly kingdom to those rightly disposed to everlasting life. Acts 13:48, Matthew 24:14. And learning about all of God's wonderful creations. A service will be held on Monday 23rd of October at 11:40 a.m. at the Kingdom Hall of Jehovah's Witnesses, 103 Silvermere Road, Leeds. Elizabeth requests that all guests wear bright colours, please. Family flowers only. Donations in lieu to St. Anne's Hospice. I picture the funeral. The coffin being lowered while his wife and children weep, wearing bright colours, celebrating a life that brought so much pain to me. I see the elders lining up to sing his praises, talking about Brother Bowler's kindness and godliness. My hands are shaking as I open my laptop and search for more evidence, wanting to be sure. I discover Bernie's Facebook page and remember her giving evidence against me at the Judicial Committee hearing. She's posted a picture of her father calling him my rock and guardian. Dozens of her friends have commented, sending their condolences. I want to add a comment calling him an evil pervert, but I'm too scared. You'd think after more than 20 years I'd be free of Mr. Bowler, but I still wake some nights with the smell of fish and chips in my nostrils and a voice telling me to open my eyes. I keep them closed. I don't want to see his face. I could never explain to my therapists or social workers how society misuses words like horror and monster. For me, horror is something that infects me like a disease, and my monster can be conjured up by the smell of vinegar on chips. I don't want to be a victim, which is why I downplay what happened, telling myself that I slept with my abuser only a handful of times and that Mr. Bowler truly loved me. But I'm arguing against my own memories, detoxing details, trying to convince myself it was less awful or that I'm untouched by what happened, when in reality it has poisoned everything. I was pregnant and 15, and my church and family had disowned me. As we drove home from Kingdom Hall that evening, my mother quietly sobbed and my stepfather gripped the steering wheel with white-knuckled intensity. Later, lying in bed, I listened to them arguing while the creature inside me whispered, I told you not to tell. I told you not to tell. Next morning, the sun rose unexpectedly, because I did not believe that any day could follow the previous one. My stepfather told me I wasn't going to school. Instead, he drove me to a large Victorian house in a quiet street on the outskirts of Newcastle. I looked at the bay windows and soot-stained walls and wondered if it might be an orphanage or a children's home. What is this place? It's a clinic, he said. I'm not sick. A group of protesters were on the opposite side of the road, holding banners and posters. One of the placards read, A person is a person, no matter how small. They were singing a hymn, Amazing Grace. I want to keep my baby, I said. My stepfather spoke softly, holding my hand. Maybe if you were older. I'm nearly 16. You're barely 15. This way you'll get to finish school and go to college and have a career. One day you'll get married and have a family.
I didn't lie to the elders.
I know.
Mr. Bowler is the father.
We let Jehovah decide these things. Two security doors had to be unlocked before we reached the reception area. My hands were shaking so much that my stepfather had to fill out the forms. A nurse came to fetch me, a smiley woman with skin so black it almost shone purple under the fluorescent lights. Her braided hair was threaded with brightly coloured beads that clacked as she walked. "I need to speak to Agatha alone," she said to my stepfather. He tried to argue. She told him to be quiet and sit down. I don't think I'd ever heard any woman speak to him like that.
"Remember what we decided," he said as the nurse led me away.
She took me to an examination room with a low bed, a desk, and an ultrasound machine. I wondered if this was where it happened, the termination. Jehovah doesn't condone abortion. Mr. Bowler taught me that in our scripture classes at Kingdom Hall, which would have seemed ironic if I wasn't so frightened.
"Hello, Agatha. My name is Janice," said the nurse. "Why are you here today?"
"I'm pregnant."
"I see. And why have you come here?"
"I'm too young to have a baby."
"How old are you, Agatha?"
15.
"How long have you been having sex?"
"Since I was 13.
"Were you raped?"
"No, I mean, it wasn't rape. We did it, you know, we both decided."
I glanced anxiously at the door. "The man in the waiting room, is he your father?"
"My stepfather."
"Is he the father of your baby?"
"No."
Janice asked me to hop up on the bed and lie down. "I'm going to do an ultrasound to confirm the pregnancy and see how advanced it is. Then I'll take a blood test and a medical history."
She pulled up my blouse and smeared gel on my stomach.
"I'm sorry if it's cold."
"That's okay."
"Would you like to see the fetus?"
"No."
I paused.
"Thank you for asking."
"You look about 12 weeks. Does that sound right?"
I nodded.
She wiped down my stomach with a paper towel and told me to button my blouse. "Have you told the father?"
"Yes."
"How old is he?"
"I don't know."
"Is he your age?"
I shook my head.
"Is he much older than you?"
I didn't answer.
"Have you considered talking to the police?"
"I can't do that."
"Why not?"
Again, I said nothing. Janice didn't get angry or make me feel ashamed. She gave me a drink of apple juice in a box with a straw and held my hand, speaking in a gentle voice. I almost told her about Mr. Bowler. I almost said, "Help me."
"Agatha, I need to be sure that you're not being pressured or rushed into making this decision. It's important that you're safe. You're safe here. Nobody can hurt you. Was it your decision to come here?"
"My parents want this."
"What do you want?"
"I don't know."
"Agatha, there are rules about terminations. Unless you give me the right reasons, it cannot happen."
"What reasons?"
"I can't put those words in your mouth."
"I don't know what to do."
"Have you considered giving the baby up for adoption?"
"Is that possible?"
"Yes. My advice is to talk to your parents. They may be disappointed, but I'm sure they love you and will support whatever decision you make."
We walked in silence back to my stepfather's car. He held the door open for me. As I passed him, he slapped me in the face. Pain washed up and down in my eyes. He raised his hand, but didn't hit me again. I put on 48 pounds during the pregnancy and haven't worn a bikini since. At school, I sat by myself like a leper whose condition might be infectious. It didn't matter that other girls were having sex. I was having a baby. One lunch hour, I arrived at the canteen to find that every girl had shoved a jumper up a blouse and was standing in the queue, backs arched and legs bowed, waddling forward to collect a tray. The boys were laughing and hooting, enjoying the spectacle. Keeping my head down, I ate my food, determined not to cry. Afterwards, I walked home through flurries of snow that made me miss Elijah because he loved the snow. He was lucky to be dead, I thought, because he didn't have to experience such cruelty. I stopped going to school and stayed home for the last 2 months, watching TV and eating too much, waiting for my baby to be born. I didn't go to meetings at Kingdom Hall, and I didn't talk to my stepfather. My mother acted as though everything was normal, ignoring my pregnancy and treating me like a child. My waters broke in the middle of the night, and I was taken to a maternity hospital. My voice, strangely detached, roared and groaned and whimpered for 12 hours as my baby fought to come out, and my body fought to keep it inside. She was born at 2:24 p.m. on the 24th of March, weighing 5 pounds 9 ounces. The midwife put her on my stomach while she cut the cord. Such a tiny baby, with a wrinkled, mucky face and fine, wispy hair. Her eyes were closed in concentration, as though she was making a wish. I studied every feature of her, every wrinkle, curve, hollow and hue, the rise and fall of her chest, the curling of her fingers, the softness of her skin, her smell, her touch, her warmth, her beauty. I imprinted her onto my brain, creating a template that is just as vivid today. The adoptive parents were waiting outside. I had met them once for a few minutes. They were awkward and nervous, but seemed nice enough. A social worker came to my bedside. "I'm here to collect her," she said, not making eye contact with me. All through the pregnancy, I had refused to envision this moment, forcing it out of my mind, telling myself I was doing the right thing. Now, everything changed. I had created a tiny, fragile, perfect human being, someone who belonged to me, my flesh and blood, my baby, who would love me, and I would love her back. "I'm not giving her away," I whispered. My mother answered, "You can't do that, Aggie." "Why? She's mine." "You signed a paper." "Tear it up." The social worker reached for my baby. I tightened my grip. "I've changed my mind. Don't take her. She's mine." "I don't want to get physical," the social worker said, grabbing at my wrists. I kicked at her. She swore. Two hospital orderlies held me down, peeling back my fingers and forcing my arms down, pulling my baby away. My mother hugged me. I fought her. I cried. I begged. "Please, please, give her back," I went on screaming as the social worker carried my baby away. I screamed to wake the sleeping and rattle the air and lift birds from the trees. I screamed for someone, anyone, to help me. But nobody came. Nobody listened. A needle slid into my arm. My brain grew foggy. I will never forgive my mother for what she did. Mr. Bowler may have robbed me of my childhood, but my mother and stepfather stole my future. 2 weeks later, I ran away from home. They brought me back. I ran away again. A series of foster homes followed. When I turned 18, I asked the adoption agency about my daughter. That's when I discovered my mother's ultimate act of betrayal. She had tricked me into signing a document saying that I would seek no future contact with my child. With one flick of the pen in my childish handwriting, I condemned myself to a lifetime of wondering. Wondering if I did the right thing. Wondering if she's happy. Wondering if she ever thinks of me. Every mother who gives up a baby has these questions. But for me, they echo loudest, because I have no other children to ease the pain. My daughter will be 23 now. She could be at university. She could live a few streets away. She could be strolling down King's Road in Chelsea, hips swinging and handbag swaying, checking her reflection in the shop windows. I have no legal right to search for her, but now that she's over 18, my daughter can look for me. That is my hope, my dream, my prayer to the God who turned his back on me. I hope that one day I will open the door and she will be standing on the step. I will tell her that I didn't abandon her and that I have loved and cherished her for 22 years. My daughter. My first child. The one who survived.
Megan.
Simon has left me a dozen text messages, all of them the same. He wants to see me. I've turned off my mobile and chosen to ignore him. In the meantime, I try to cheer myself up with some retail therapy. John Lewis has a babywear and nursery department on the third floor, as well as a maternity section and gift service. My fashion advisor, Caitlin, is annoyingly perky, and clearly has never had a muffin, let alone a baby. I let her show me outfits and sell me spa treatments. One particular dress catches my eye. It's black and elegant, and I have nothing in my wardrobe even half as beautiful.
"Sadly, we don't have it in your size," says Caitlin.
I don't like her tone. I don't like her skinny waist and her flat stomach and her high cheekbones. I take the black dress and head for the changing rooms, where I strip down to my bra and maternity knickers. Unzipping the black dress, I lift it over my head. The layers of silk begin to slide over my shoulders, and then they don't. I tug, squirm and pull, slowly working the dress down over my breasts and my bump. I look at myself in the mirror. It's horrible. The once sleek dress balloons out from under my bust like an empire waist ball gown. Pop a bonnet on my head, and I could audition for Pride and Prejudice, the morning years. Seizing the hem, I pull it over my head, forgetting to unzip the side. Halfway up, my arms lock. I'm stuck. I can't get my arms back down, and I can't get the dress over my head. I glimpse myself through the sweetheart neckline and see a strange, misshapen, black and white creature whose stomach bulges over the top of her grandma knickers. I don't look pregnant. I look like I ate all the pies.
"Is everything all right?"
says Caitlin, speaking from the other side of the door. "I'm having a small problem with the dress."
"I'll get the manager."
"No, that's okay." I heave at the dress, huffing and puffing. The manager has arrived, talking through the door.
"What seems to be the problem?"
"Nothing." I curse some more. The lock rattles. The door swings open. I cannot lower my arms to cover my bits. The manager and Caitlin and three shoppers are witness to my retailing horror, seeing my purple veins, stretch marks, and dimples of cellulite.
"You're stuck," says Caitlin, stating the obvious. "I told you it wasn't your size."
"Bitch. It fitted me just fine. I forgot to unzip it, that's all." The manager and Caitlin have to pull the dress off me, almost costing me an ear. "Would you like to try something else on?" asks the manager.
"No, thank you. This one is fine."
I get dressed, my face on fire, and static electricity having made my hair fly around my head. I pay for the dress and walk out of John Lewis, picturing the staff laughing at me. I can never go back. I blame Simon. If I weren't so worried, I would never have tried on that dress. Arriving home, I discover more messages on the answering machine. What if Jack had picked them up first? I have to stop this. The phone rings again. I don't recognize the number.
"If you hang up on me, I'll come to the house," says Simon.
My finger is paused over the button to disconnect. "Please, leave me alone."
"We have to sort this out."
"No! Stop texting me. Stop calling. I don't want to see you again."
"You have no choice."
"I'll call the police."
"Fine. Call them."
I want to kill the arrogant fuck, but there's nothing I can do. I can't involve the police or take out a restraining order without Jack finding out. Simon knows I'll do anything to protect my marriage and family.
"I don't want to hurt anyone," he says quietly. "Meet me. Let me explain."
At high tide on the Thames path at Kew, the water has breached the banks in places, trickling across the towpath, turning into puddles and muddy pools. I wait on a bench seat, watching a rowing eight skate across the river, creating ripples that angle like a feathered arrow.
"Sorry I'm late," says Simon.
"We're both early," I reply, standing to meet him, not hiding my anger. He's come straight from the office, wearing a rumpled suit and loosened tie, the picture of studied nonchalance. Sunglasses are propped on his head. He leans close, as though expecting an embrace, but I step back and away. "What is it, Simon? I have to get home."
We begin walking along the path beneath the trees where the last of the leaves have turned, yet cling stubbornly to the branches. Simon clears his throat.
When the baby is born, I want a paternity test done.
The gasp of breath is mine, but sounds like it comes from behind me.
What?
You heard me.
I stop walking and step to the side of the path. A jogger passes, nodding hello. My fingernails are cutting into my bald fists.
You have to stop this. Jack is your best friend. He's my husband. What happened between us was wrong. We admitted that. We promised never to speak of it again.
That was before.
Before?
I want to be a father.
This baby has a father.
You don't understand.
Explain it to me.
He takes in a deep breath, as though the story is like a balloon that needs inflating.
I don't have a father. I have only vague memories. He's a man in a photograph standing next to a VW Beetle in the driveway of a house. He's someone banging on the door, begging my mother to let him come inside, his voice getting louder, angrier. My brother and I were cringing in the darkness. My mother threatened to call the police. A few years later, my brother saw a man standing opposite our school. He followed my brother home, but never crossed the road. My mother called the police, but the man had gone when they arrived. For years, I told myself that I didn't care about not having a dad. Loads of kids come from broken homes. Some are better off than if their fathers had stuck around. When I turned 14, I began asking questions. My mother wouldn't answer them. I went searching among her things and found the photograph, the one of him standing next to the VW. I asked her if it was him, but she snatched the picture away and accused me of stealing. I never saw it again.
I don't know why Simon is telling me this. I want him to get to the point because my feet ache and I need to pee.
A year after I finished school, I visited my grandmother in Scotland, whose mind had started to scatter. She told me my father was a master of get-rich-quick schemes that always seemed to fail, leading to bankruptcy and bailiffs knocking on his door. Even as she told me the story, I remembered my mother in tears, watching our furniture being carried out of the house and loaded into a truck. After I graduated, I was living with my mother. A water main burst and flooded her basement where she kept old letters and postcards. Most were water-damaged. I began throwing things away. In one of the boxes I came across dozens of unopened letters. They were addressed to my brother and me. There were birthday and Christmas cards dating back to when we were children, all sent by our father. He didn't abandon us. He had tried to stay in touch.
If he'd really wanted...
Please, let me finish, says Simon, grimacing and apologizing for his tone. I started searching for my father. I tried the usual channels, phone books and electoral rolls. I hired a private investigator. It took 6 months and most of my savings. An email arrived with two attachments, a death certificate, and the findings of a coroner's inquest. My father had died of a drug overdose in Morocco. He was 47.
Simon looks at me, pain etched into his forehead, and I feel a flutter of sympathy.
I know what you're thinking, he says. The guy was a loser and we were better off without him. But I have mourned the absence of that man for my entire life. It probably seems ridiculous to miss someone I barely met, but I've always wondered if his absence was the cause of my problems with women. Is that why I can't commit to a relationship? I also wonder if it's easier for children who lose a father they have grown to love. They can mourn an absence or try to fill the space that was once taken. I have no space to fill, but I still feel empty. Maybe the separation wasn't worse on him than me. Did he worry about me? Did he mourn for me? Is that why he turned to drugs?
That's a big leap, I say.
Maybe, he shrugs. But I don't want to be like him, Megs. I don't want to waste any part of my life. And that includes being a father.
He delivers this last statement as though pleading with me. I fight the urge to prick his grandiosity. I have seen Simon snort more coke than Charlie Sheen, and change women more often than his designer ties. I hold my tongue and stay calm.
There is a difference here, Simon,
I say, speaking softly. You grew up without a father. My children have one.
But is Jack the right father?
He is the only father.
I want to be in my son's life.
He is not your son. He has nothing to do with you.
I have a right to know if he's mine.
You have no rights.
I talked to a lawyer. He said I could have a case. He said a judge might order a paternity test.
I raise my eyes skywards. Christ, Simon, have you any idea? This will destroy my family.
He goes quiet, inhales, whispers. Please understand. I don't want to upset you, but I've thought about this. I've thought about you.
What does that mean?
Simon's face seems to be shape-shifting in the dappled light. Do you ever think about our time together? Back before you met Jack?
No.
The answer seems to sting him. I was devastated when you left me.
He was stoned most of the time.
I was in love with you.
Rubbish!
I told you so.
You told every girl you loved her. It was part of your foreplay.
You're wrong. He touches my arm and makes me turn to face him. I have said those words to two women in my life. One of them was my mother. The other is you.
I study his face, looking for some sign that he's lying. Are you saying...
Yes.
You're still...
in love with you.
He seems to hold his breath, waiting for me to answer. I can't. He fills the silence, giving me a history lesson, recounting our first date and our first weekend away, and our trip to Paris for Easter. He remembers everything, right down to what I was wearing when he first saw me.
I've tried to forget you. I went to live in America, and then Hong Kong. I dated loads of other women, hoping that one of them would make me forget you. I can't tell you how it felt when I came back to London for Jack's wedding and discovered that he was marrying you.
I was happy for him. I carried on. I pretended it didn't matter. I told myself that I'd meet someone, fall in love, and forget that I ever felt this way.
He hesitates. That night, when you fought with Jack and came to see me, I hate myself for saying this, but a small part of me hoped, wanted, wished I could tell you how I felt. I know what we did was wrong, but I can't deny my feelings anymore. And if that night led to this,
he points at my pregnancy.
If you're carrying our child, I want to play a part. I love you, Megs. Always have. Always will.
His arms close around me, but I do not soften. My body grows hard like a mannequin, and I push him away. My mind is racing. All these years, the dinners, the barbecues, the tennis and golf games, the Christmases and christenings, did I give Simon false hope? Am I a terrible person? I have to go, I mumble, looking around me, suddenly lost. How could I have missed this? I've known Simon for years. I know he's prone to wheedling self-pity and sodden promises, but not love. Does he expect me to choose between him and Jack?
I'm sorry, Megs, Simon says. I wish I could do this without hurting anyone. But I can't live with the thought that a child came into the world not knowing his true father.
It happens all the time.
And it's wrong.
Is this about me or the baby?
Both of you.
The glibness of his answer triggers something inside me. I spin around and slap him hard across the face. It stings my hand. I have never hit anyone before. You truly are a selfish prick.
I love you.
No, don't you dare say that. If you loved me, you would have sent me away that night instead of getting me drunk.
Simon starts to protest. I interrupt him. If you go through with this,
if you insist on a paternity test, I will make sure that you never see this child. You will never hold him in your arms. You will never again enter our house.
You will be dead to me.
Agatha, this is my last day at the supermarket.
I asked Mr. Patel if he could write me a reference, but he said he didn't know me well enough. What an arsehole. Consequently, I don't feel guilty about stealing a Snickers bar and a can of Coca-Cola when I sneak outside on my break. Abigail joins me, lighting up a cigarette and waving the smoke away from me. We've perched our buttocks on a low brick wall behind the bins, beneath an ivy-covered trellis.
I won't be staying long, she says. I've applied for a job at the new Apple store in Regent Street. They give you free T-shirts.
What about discounts?
Yeah, I need a new iPhone.
She shows me her broken screen. I like Abigail because she is unapologetically loud and is far more adventurous than I am. She once hitchhiked across Europe and spent a month travelling in Turkey by herself. On top of that, she rides a motorbike and has no interest in getting married. But that could be because her boyfriend has a wife and two kids. Mr. Patel whistles out the back door. We've had our 15 minutes. He wants me to mop the floor in the produce section, which is always the dirtiest spot. I fill a bucket with hot water and wheel it out of the storeroom. Excuse me, says a male voice. I step to one side and mumble an apology. It's not until he's gone past me that I realize who it is. Jack is scanning the shelves in the pharmacy section. He doesn't have a basket or trolley. It's a quick purchase, something forgotten perhaps. He picks up condoms and reads the packet, trying to decide which brand or size to buy. Having made a decision, he goes to the checkout. Abigail has a little smirk on her lips as she rings up the sale. Something about the scene makes me uncomfortable. Why would Jack be buying condoms? I set down the mop and walk to the front window. A car is double parked out front, a black BMW convertible with a woman driver. I recognize her. It's the estate agent who showed me round the house in Cleveland Gardens that Jack and Meg eventually bought. I watch as Jack gets into the passenger seat. What's wrong? Asks Abigail. Nothing. Do you know him?
No.
I return to mopping the floor, sloshing water angrily. It's obvious what's happening. Jack is cheating on Meg. He's sleeping with that stiletto-wearing, Botox-frozen, painted whore of an estate agent. How dare she break up my perfect family? What if Jack leaves Meg? What if she kicks him out? At 3 o'clock, I collect my last payslip and say goodbye to Abigail and the other girls. Having changed into my winter coat, I walk along the back lane, heading into Barnes Village. Pausing outside the estate agent's window, I look at the glossy photographs of flats and houses for sale. Below the specs for each property, there is contact information and a photograph of the agent. Rhea Bowden, that's her name. I remember how she fawned over me when I looked at the house and asked if my husband wanted a private viewing. There is a payphone at the pub. I call the estate agency. A receptionist answers, young and plummy.
Can I speak to Rhea Bowden? I ask. She's not in the office this afternoon. Can I take a message?
I'm calling from home base. One of our drivers is trying to deliver bathroom tiles but can't find her house. We must have the wrong address.
Bathroom tiles?
I tried her mobile number, no answer. I think she has a tiler waiting for them. I hear her tapping at her keyboard. It's 34 Milgarth Avenue, Barnes. Right road, wrong number, I say. Thanks for your help. The address is less than half a mile away. Detouring slightly, I stop at the Barnes fish shop and buy 2 pounds of cooked prawns. The fishmonger is full of banter about fish being good for pregnant ladies.
You know why fish are so smart?
He chirps. They swim in schools, I reply.
You've heard that one.
Noah heard that one. Rhea Bowden lives in a pretty detached cottage in a street with lots of trees and builder's skips. There are two types of cars in places like this. The stockbroker brands like Mercedes, BMWs or Audis, and the cool cars like Mini Coopers, Aston Martins or original Beetles. Jack's car is parked across the road behind the BMW convertible. Slipping through the main gate, I take the narrow side path past a rusting bicycle chained to a post. As I pass each window, I crouch to avoid casting a shadow on the curtains. At the rear of the house, I hear music and voices. Stepping in a flower bed, I stand on tiptoes and peer through a window, seeing the corner of a bed and a discarded pair of trousers on the floor, a shoe, a shirt, a blouse. Holding the window ledge, I scrabble upwards, lifting my chin higher. This time, I see Rhea Bowden dressed in black lingerie. She's straddling Jack, bracing her hands on his chest and rapidly jerking her hips. Her belly is jiggling, and Jack reaches up and massages her breasts beneath the camisole. She's talking dirty to him, grinding her hips and moaning like a porn star. A part of me is disgusted, and another part wants to keep watching. I contemplate interrupting them. I could ring Rhea's doorbell or set off her car alarm. No, that's too childish. Retreating along the path, I walk to Jack's car and tear a page from a notepad in my handbag. I picture Jack inside having a post-coital cigarette while Rhea douches in the bidet. She's the sort of woman who'll have a bidet because it makes her feel more European and sophisticated. Dear Jack, I know you're having an affair. I know where and when. I have photographs of you and Rhea Bowden together. I also know your wife's pregnant. End the affair now, or I'm going to tell Meg. You don't deserve her. Asshole. Yours honestly, a friend. Folding the page in half, I tuck it beneath the wiper blades of Jack's car. Checking the street again, I wander along to Rhea's BMW and crouch beside the near side tyre. Unwrapping the prawns, I begin cramming them into the hubcaps, moving from wheel to wheel, and then the air vents and grill. Some of the heads break off, but I shove them through the gaps. It'll take a few days for the prawns to rot. At first, Rhea will wonder where the stench is coming from and blame the neighbours. But slowly she'll narrow it down, because the smell will keep following her around. Satisfied with my work, I wash my hands under a nearby tap. Hopefully, I've done enough to teach Jack a lesson. If not, I'll send the next letter to him at home. I need him to stay married to Meg and be faithful, and to raise Lucy and Lachlan. I might not be the most moral person, but I will not let them break up. Soon, they're going to need each other. Megan. What am I going to do about Simon? I am trapped by his demands, caught between my infidelity and his misguided declarations of love. A rock and a hard place, the frying pan and the fire. Memories of our night together keep popping into my head, creating waves of shame and emotions that swing between murderous rage and my complete surrender. What if I were to tell Jack and beg for forgiveness? It was just sex, I'd say. It meant nothing. How pathetically trite. Just sex is what every unfaithful spouse says, as though putting just in front of a word minimizes the betrayal. Do I also tell Jack that Simon is in love with me and I once had a relationship with him? Surely it makes everything worse because I've kept it hidden. I should have told Jack from the very beginning, but it was the night before our wedding. This is Simon's fault. He professes to love me, but I don't think he's capable of loving anyone other than himself. He's an opportunist and a dilettante. You can see it in the girlfriends he chooses, who are dull-witted and earnest, and never his intellectual equal. Underneath his charm and lavish good looks is a man lacking in emotional conviction or depth. He has no idea what it takes to hold a family together or to maintain a relationship, and the only reason he wants a child is because it would make him more interesting. Grace wants to take me for a girl's day out because I cancelled her plans for a baby shower. She's booked us into a day spa just off Sloane Square and insisted on driving. I hope they have a whale wash, I say, but she ignores me and says self-pity is proof that I need pampering. The spa is hidden discreetly behind a heavy wooden door. The decor has a southern Asian feel, like some idyllic Malaysian oasis, with teak carvings, marble floors and sandalwood scents. Grace won't let me look at the price list. This is my treat, she says, sipping on her first glass of champagne. 3 hours from now we're going to feel like new women. She's not wrong. Soon I'm being pummeled, rubbed, stroked, stretched and perfumed until I fall asleep and drool on my towel. A couple of the male masseurs keep vying to get their hands on Grace, who has that effect on men and boys, straight or gay.
We were so different growing up. Grace was rebellious and headstrong, while I was timid and eager to please. Each time I won new freedoms because of my maturity, Grace would get hers taken away.
"Give that girl an inch and she thinks she's a ruler," my father would say.
I studied English at Edinburgh, choosing a university as far away from home as I could find. I passed my exams, graduated with a first, all the while watching Grace talk her way into nightclubs at 16, get drunk, chain-smoke, wear miniskirts, and run away to Europe for 2 years pretending to be a hippie. Eventually she came home and went to university, somehow passing her exams. I suspect she slept with some of her tutors, but that's my jealousy showing. For most of that time I thought we had nothing in common, but we're closer now. She's easy company, never trying too hard to impress or make me laugh. "How about lunch?" she says as we're leaving. "Only if you let me pay." Her car is parked in a side street. We walk, arm in arm, still drowsy from the spa.
"You've been quiet all morning. Is everything all right?" she asks. "Is it Jack?"
"No."
"The kids?"
"They're great." I take a deep breath. My voice shudders. "I'm in trouble."
"Bit late now," she laughs, looking at my bump.
Her smile vanishes because I'm not joining in. "I can't tell anyone. I can't tell you."
"Sure you can. We tell each other everything."
"Not this."
Tears are hovering. I wipe them away angrily.
Across the street, I notice a removal van with its back doors propped open. Two men are carrying a sofa from a house and hauling it up the ramp. I imagine that it's my home and Jack is divorcing me.
"Come on, Megs, don't cry. It can't be that bad."
"I fucked up. I did something truly stupid." My voice trembles. "It only happened once. I was drunk. Angry."
I stop. Sigh. Steel myself.
Grace frowns.
"What are you talking about?"
"I slept with Simon."
Grace doesn't react. She can barely speak.
"Jack and I had a fight. He said some hurtful things. He said he wanted out of the marriage. I went to Simon's house. I wanted to know if Jack had said anything to him. Did he still love me?" Simon poured me a drink. We talked. I cried. He put his arm around me. It was really stupid.
"You had an affair?"
"It was one time."
"You? Miss Goody Two-Shoes?"
"Please don't."
"I mean, I know it happens all the time, but not to you."
"I know. I know."
"Didn't you have a fling with him before you met Jack?"
"Yes."
She sucks air between her teeth, making a whistling sound. We've reached her car. She unlocks the doors and we sit in silence, staring out the windscreen. I bite my bottom lip.
"Say something."
I'm shocked.
"Is that all?"
I feel a little vindicated.
"Why?"
"You were always little Miss Perfect, the favourite daughter. You could do no wrong."
"I wasn't the favourite. Compared to you, I was sensible."
"Until now."
"Why are we arguing about this?"
Grace has both her hands on the wheel. I wonder how much she's had to drink. There is an edge to her voice. "Get over it, sister."
"What?"
"You're feeling guilty. Get over it. Move on."
"It's not that. There's more. Simon thinks the baby is his."
This time, her mouth opens and shuts without a sound emerging. She tries again. "Is it?"
"No, definitely not."
I'm shaking my head adamantly, trying to appear confident. "So why does he think it is?"
"He has this stupid idea because, you see, I asked him about whether he used a condom, so he thought..."
"So it could be Simon's baby."
"He said he used a condom."
"You don't remember?" I shake my head. Grace laughs.
"It's not funny."
"It's a nervous laugh, okay? But why does any of this matter? If you both keep quiet, nobody will ever know."
"Simon wants to know. He's demanding I take a paternity test after the baby is born."
"Tell him no."
"I told him."
Grace is finally fully engaged and cognizant of my problem. She is angry, which is good. She has a first-class mind and third-class morals, which is exactly what I need right now if I'm going to stop Simon. I'll talk to him, says Grace. It won't do any good. I can be very persuasive. You're not going to... What? Nothing. Her eyes narrow and create twin creases that concertina on her forehead. No, Meg, I'm not going to sleep with him. Contrary to your perception of me, that's not my answer to everything. Sorry. We need something on him. Like what? Dirt. That won't work. Didn't he used to take a lot of drugs? So did lots of people. Did he deal in them? Yes. A little. Maybe we can blackmail the blackmailer to guarantee his silence. I'm sure his bosses won't be impressed by employing a former drug dealer. Grace is on a roll, enjoying this a little too much. No, we're not going to blackmail him. I don't want anyone getting hurt. Hey, this is war, big sister. We have to fight fire with fire, or in this case, dirt with dirt. She squeezes my hand. If this doesn't work out, you might have to tell Jack. I know. What will he do? I wish I knew. Agatha. Jules went into hospital yesterday and had her baby in the early hours. I heard the news from Kevin, who came home this morning to shower and change. A little girl, he said breathlessly when I met him on the stairs. How's Jules? Brilliant. No dramas. It was textbook, according to the midwife. They'll be home later today. So soon? Jules doesn't want to stay in hospital. I'm off to pick up Leo from my mum so he can meet his baby sister. If you need any help, I said, but Kevin was already skipping down the stairs. I imagine Hayden being like that when he becomes a father. He'll be bouncing around the place like a red setter puppy. He'll be clumsy, of course. I'll have to teach him how to hold a baby and change a nappy, but he'll soon get the hang of things. Later that afternoon, I hear Jules arriving home. Kevin is carrying the baby in a car seat, while Jules struggles with her overnight bag and two bunches of flowers, one of them from me. I got a new sister, brags Leo as he climbs past me on the stairs. Taking the flowers from Jules, I give her a hug and follow her up to the flat, where I make a cup of tea and put water in vases, arranging the bouquets on the table. Kevin wants to go out with his mates and celebrate the old-fashioned way with beer and cigars. To wet the baby's head, he says. But if you want me to stay... No, you go, says Jules. Say hello to the boys from me, and don't get too pissed. I won't. He peers into the crib. A little girl. Have you decided on a name? I ask. We're thinking of Violet, says Jules. That's pretty. Kevin grabs his coat and kisses her on the forehead, calling her a clever girl. I hear him jogging down the stairs, taking them two at a time and swinging across each landing. So, how was it really? I ask. I want all the gory details. She smiles tiredly. Easier than last time. Great. You'll be fine. I listen as Jules describes her labour and the delivery. She has photographs on her phone. Some of them show Violet in the minutes after her birth, being cleaned and weighed by a midwife. Kevin was really good. You'll be glad that Hayden is with you, she says wearily. Her words are beginning to lose shape. Leo has come to peer into the crib. He looks at me. When is your baby coming out? Soon. Are you still bleeding? No. I laugh nervously and ruffle his hair. What do you mean, sweetie? Asks Jules. She's looking at Leo. Nothing, I say, my heart hammering. I spilled something on my skirt. Leo thought it was blood. Leo wants to say something else. I interrupt him and tell him Mummy needs to rest. I'll look after Leo. You have a nap. Are you sure? Absolutely. I took Jules into bed and she's asleep within moments. Leo has gone to the sitting room where he's watching TV. I sit next to him and make him look at me. I didn't bleed, but I saw. I spilled something. He nods, more interested in the TV. Listen to me, I say, squeezing his upper arm. You shouldn't tell lies. He tries to pull away. He knows. He knows. He's a child. What if he tells someone? Nobody will believe him,
Stupid. Stupid.
Leaving Leo, I return to the bedroom, quietly opening the door, making sure that Jules is sleeping. Tiptoeing across the floor, I take a nightdress from the dresser drawer before going to the small, painted crib and gently lifting Violet into my arms. I carry her out of the room, shielding her from Leo's gaze when he turns back to look at me reproachfully. He goes back to watching TV. Slipping into Leo's bedroom, I lay Violet on the floor between two pillows and quickly remake the bed, pulling back the SpongeBob duvet and taking plain sheets from the linen cupboard. Retrieving two bunches of flowers from the kitchen, I arrange them on either side of the bed. The only other furniture in the room is a chest of drawers with a tilting beveled mirror on top. Using books and soft toys, I prop my phone next to the mirror and turn on the camera, adjusting the angle to put the bed in the center of the frame. Some of Leo's drawings have been stuck on the wall above the bed. I pull them off gently, trying not to tear the corners. Once I'm satisfied, I take off my clothes and the prosthetic bump before slipping the nightgown over my head. I dampen my hair using Leo's water bottle, plastering strands on my forehead and splashing water on my face, before picking up Violet, who is still swaddled in a crocheted woolen blanket. Half sitting up in bed, I hold her in the crook of my arm so that only part of her face can be seen. She smells so beautiful, so clean and new. Using the timer, I take multiple photographs, checking the composition after each one. Satisfied, I unhook my bra and press Violet's face into my breast, smiling tiredly at the camera. This time, I'm recording.
Hello, everyone. This is Rory. I would love to show you his face, but he's pretty hungry right now. I'm exhausted, but so, so happy.
Violet has woken. She snuffles and opens her mouth, searching for my nipple. I set her down and stop the recording before quickly rearranging the room. Violet is now fully awake, and her cries are getting louder. I pull off the nightdress and begin fastening my prosthetic. I hear a sound from the main bedroom. Jules is awake.
"Where's Violet?"
she asks, panic straining her voice.
"She's with me,"
I reply, wrestling with my clothes. Jules is in the hallway. At the door. I'm breathless.
"What are you doing?"
asks Jules.
"Violet was restless. I didn't want her waking you."
"How long did I sleep?"
"Not long. I think she might be hungry."
Jules picks up Violet from the bed and points to my blouse.
"Your buttons aren't done up properly."
"Oh, silly me. I'd forget my head."
"Are you okay?"
"Fine." I make Jules go back to her bedroom and prop pillows behind her back. Once she's breastfeeding, I put Leo's drawings back on the wall, but can't quite remember the sequence. Hopefully Jules won't remember either. I'm returning the flowers to the kitchen when I spy Violet's PCHR booklet. The personal health record is given to every newborn, listing details of the birth, weight, length and head circumference, as well as the name of the midwife and family doctor. I'm going to need a booklet like this. I begin photographing the pages. Jules appears.
"What are you doing?"
"Nothing. I mean, I'm just looking. How's Violet?" "Full as a fat lady's socks."
"Cup of tea?"
"No."
"How about a piece of toast?"
"Two." I get bread from the freezer and fill the slots of the toaster.
"I didn't get a picture of Violet," I say. "Can I have one of yours?"
"Sure." Jules unlocks her phone and hands it to me. I scroll through the images and find one that I want. It shows the midwife weighing Violet. I send the picture to my phone, which chirrups in my pocket.
"Is there anything else I can do?"
I ask. "I could make dinner for Leo."
"No, you've been wonderful."
"I'll be fine." "Well, I'm going downstairs to tell Hayden. He's due to call me tonight."
"Where is he now?"
8 days out of Cape Town. He'll be home a week from Wednesday."
"Well, tell him to hurry.
He doesn't want to miss this." Megan. Today I phoned an old friend who works for a law firm in the city. Jocelyn made partner this year. I'm not really sure what that means, but she celebrated by throwing a party at the Savoy Grill, so I figured a lot more money. She returns my call, shouting to be heard above the noise of traffic.
"Sorry, Megs, I'm just out of court. Have you had the baby?
Not yet.
I want to see pictures.
You will.
She whistles for a taxi. I hold the phone away from my ear. Jocelyn and I were at school together, inseparable from the age of 10, doing all the usual stuff, graduating from hopscotch and jumping.